It's at the letters for Tuesday, June 11th, 2024. Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson Smith. Our producers are Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade. Thanks so much for listening. Ben, more entertaining to you in the world of baseball oddities. You say Kikuchi trucking Tyler Soderstrom with an open field tackle, or Chris Bassett using the extendo rod to try to wrest Vladimir Guerrero Jr.'s bat from a net?
Oh, by far, it's the Kikuchi. I mean, he took Soderstrom out so hard.
And again, a ton of foul territory here. Soderstrom over, oh my! He collided. Who is that? Is that Kikuchi? He collided with Yusei Kikuchi, who was presumably trying to get out of the way.
I mean, we all know it wasn't intentional. And, you know, of course, we've since heard the comments that Yusei made to you and Shai in Oakland, which are, you know, in and of themselves. I mean, that's an incredible response. But, you know, this is, it just looked like there was so much intent behind it. And it was hilarious. Thankfully, everyone's okay. No one was harmed. The right call was made on the field at the time. It led to some great banter from Blue Jays, who, you know, may or may not have, you know, be a part-time DH on this team. It was incredible.
I am a very privileged man in that I have the best seat in the house for like 60, 70 odd Blue Jays games a year as the, you know, on-field reporter for Blue Jays broadcasts. So I had like a front row seat to not only the collision, but then obviously the brouhaha that occurred afterwards between the Blue Jays dugout and some of the Oakland players on the field. And Ben can confirm, incredibly entertaining. Of my favorite moments of the year was everything that occurred there, which says a lot about just what this Blue Jays season has looked like. But I don't think that I will ever see that ever again. I'm pretty sure I won't, because there isn't even a stadium in AAA where the players in the dugout, like, not only don't have a railing, but are literally sitting on water coolers at the top step of a dugout that really hasn't been changed at all since, you know, the mid-1960s, whenever that ballpark was built. And then, yeah, Yusei's comments afterwards, quote, "I just wanted to create a little hole and hide inside it." I can't even. Like, Shai and I, we drove back to San Francisco from that game, and it was, I don't know, in the car for like 45 minutes. I talked about that entire scene and like Yusei's comments for like 43 of those 45 minutes.
Yeah.
It's just incredible.
So entertaining.
So happy I saw it.
Yeah, it incredibly entertaining. And like you said, it could only happen in Oakland because, you know, even in Class A ballparks, right, like it's spring training, we're covering games in Florida State League ballparks. They have dugouts with railings. Like, you don't see that in pro ball, to just have essentially this field that turns into a bench with no interruption. And so it's a weird setting. And make no mistake, Yusei Kikuchi, incredible athlete, like great awareness of his surroundings. This is not a clumsy dude. I mean, we've all watched him field this position now for a few years. It's just such a rare and unexpected occurrence. And then he kind of froze, and there's this deer in headlights moment, and he runs right into Soderstrom.
Lowers the shoulder, carried his momentum through the tackle, like really just, you know, Soderstrom like caught him right on that shoulder to turn him, used his momentum against him. Like, just brilliance from Yusei Kikuchi in that hit.
Yeah, 100%. And then the comments afterwards, I mean, to hear the Blue Jays dugout, which, you know, I'm picking it up on the broadcast feed, which the Sportsnet broadcast had some pretty hot mics right there. And you can hear some Blue Jays players saying, like, "Hey, Adams, like, quit focusing on this, like, get back on the mound and pitch as well as you chirp," like that kind of thing. Definitely not holding anything back, kind of in defense of Kikuchi. And that was one of the things that, you know, it is nice to see the Blue Jays supporting Kikuchi in that moment. Clearly, he had done nothing wrong. Everyone in the dugout knew that he had done nothing wrong, and they were very quick to jump to his support and say, hey, let's back off this guy. There was no intent here.
Yeah, some of the more vocal people were actually like the fellow starters who I think, you know, were particularly inspired to come to Kikuchi's defense there. And, you know, I'll leave what was said on the field, but yeah, it was pretty good to your point. Let me also say, like, I will not miss covering games at the Coliseum. Like, whatever AAA ballpark we're going to be going to in Sacramento for the next 3 years, I'm certain is going to be an upgrade over the facilities at Oakland Coliseum. And I feel like we've done this on the podcast in the past, but like, it's just not a professional big league facility. Like, it's just not up to standard. It's embarrassing. On this particular occasion was one of many at which I had to remove cockroaches from the camera well in which I was working, like literal cockroaches climbing over my feet. I've seen rats and mice there. There is a like the access point from the visitors clubhouse to the dugout is this like very thin hallway with like these weirdly angled stairs where there's just this rope in the middle and fans on one side and like us and players and staff and coaches and everyone else on the other side, like literally just shoulder to shoulder fans with players. And at the bottom of this like long sloping hallway is just this mysterious pool of liquid that it's uncertain where it comes from, how it gets there, but it is always there, and you are always stepping over just this murky puddle of mysterious water at the bottom of this sloping pathway through which you have to pass through the stands to get to the dugout, which is like big enough for maybe like half the Blue Jays coaching staff, let alone all the support staff and like 26 players and, you know, any injured guys who are along for the ride as well. So like, just a joke of a stadium, an embarrassment to the major leagues. Sacramento is going to be an upgrade.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, it's really sad for the fans of Oakland and for the players and the staff there, you know, mostly for the fans, because they have such a history of great baseball in that city, and ownership under John Fisher has just completely let it go. So it is a really sad state of affairs there. And, you know, that even applies to the team on the field, which is under-resourced in some of the same ways that the stadium is, where you have a team that Aledmys Díaz, I'm pretty sure, is their highest paid player. You know, you're not talking about a team that really invests in major league payroll. And they're not horrible, but they're one of the worst teams in baseball. And so the Jays needed a series win in that context. And it got kind of close late on Sunday, but they were able to pull that out.
And, you know, we're talking about stuff like this, and we're talking about, you know, bats being lodged in nets for like multiple innings of a broadcast, because Blue Jays haven't given us much else on the field to talk about. Like, there haven't been a lot of signs outside of, you know, beating up on some lesser competition that the Blue Jays are really turning things around against, you know, not only like the better teams in baseball, like, you know, the Yankees and, you know, you think about the Orioles and the Guardians, etc., but even just like all these teams who are in this like murky middle, this like melee in the middle of MLB, like there's just this, like there's like, you know, six really, really good teams and six really, really bad teams, and everyone else is just in the middle hovering around 500. But whenever the Blue Jays are playing anyone around them or above, it seems like they are losing more often than not, and it seems like their offense is failing to rise to the occasion more often than not, Ben.
Yeah. Oh, that's for sure. Bobichak quietly has come around. You look at his numbers for the last month or so, he's kind of been what you'd expect from Bobichak. Vladdy obviously has been great. I mean, Vladdy, to me, this is an all-star player. This is a really, really good player.
Gets it in the air to right. Santander back. It's going to go. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. with an opposite field home run, and the Blue Jays lead 3-0.
That's a positive, but there haven't been enough of those performances from the Jays offensively. You look at George Springer and, you know, just objectively one of the worst hitters in baseball in 2024. So, you know, when you look at someone who's on a $150 million contract, someone who's not even in the last 2 years of those contract of that contract, you certainly would need more. They're just not getting it. So yeah, you know, offensively hasn't really been there. They have major questions on the pitching side, which I'm sure we'll get to. And like you say, they end up kind of in this murky middle. And it's not an awful place to be in the sense that, hey, they're three games out of a playoff spot with 98 to go as we record this. So, I mean, yeah, three games out, 98 games remaining, a lot can happen. And this is a sport, too, where because anyone can get in, because there are six spots in the playoff bracket on each side of the league, there is opportunity. You don't have to be a powerhouse to necessarily make it to the championship series, but it definitely helps. And I think at this point, the Jays have an opportunity, but I don't really see the signs that they are going to be able to turn this thing around quickly.
Yeah, as you said, over the last 30 days, Bo Bichette has a 112 WRC plus. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. has a 150 WRC plus, 50% better than league average offensively for Vlad. So like those are great things. But over the last 30 days, Bichette and Guerrero are two of only five Blue Jays who have a WRC plus above 100. So two of only five Blue Jays who are hitting above a league average rate. And the other three Blue Jays, Dalton Varsho, great. He's having a great season. He's really coming into his own. Very valuable player for this organization. The other two, Spencer Horwitz and Daniel Vogelback. And Vogelback rarely plays. Horwitz has a dozen big league plate appearances, was just called up a few days ago. So it's not good enough. Like the Blue Jays are just going to need more contributions from down their lineup. But like it's interesting even just to look at the top of the Blue Jays lineup, and like it's just says so much about where we've arrived at in this season, and just how much like the desperation for the Blue Jays has been ratcheted up. Like you look across baseball and you think about like some of the, you know, better 1-2 punches out there, right? Like you think about like Mookie Betts and Shohei Ohtani atop the Dodgers lineup, or like Gunnar and Adley with
Judge and Soto.
Yeah, you know, Altuve, Bregman, right, with the Astros, or Schwarber and Harper and Realmuto, however they kind of configure things behind Schwarber at the top, like these great 1-2 punches, tough lineups to face and for a pitcher to work their way through, facing dangerous dudes immediately from the jump in the first inning. For the Blue Jays of late, it's been Schneider, Horwitz, 1-2. And that just kind of says it all about, and by merit, by the way, Schneider, Horwitz, 1-2. That just says it all about where the Blue Jays have arrived.
Right. And you know, David Schneider quietly in the last month, he's actually really struggled. That's another one to kind of figure out for the Blue Jays here. IKF has kind of been holding his own, kind of slightly below league average all season. You'll take that with his big hits that he's had, with his defense that he's had. You need IKF at this point. So yeah, it's an offensive group that continues to kind of underwhelm. I think that bringing up Spencer Horwitz is a good call. I think that that's something that this group needed. And, you know, last week, as this, you know, his performance continued to be really, really good at AAA, and they were in need of a bat, it became more and more clear they were seriously considering him. Then, of course, he joins the team in Oakland, and he's been getting chances, which I think he should, because even if he's a singles, doubles, walks guy, those are good outcomes. You want guys who can hit a double, who can draw a walk. And Horwitz, I think, should be able to do that, at least give him the chance, see if he can do it. So we're going to watch that storyline unfold here.
Yeah, it's interesting talking to him in Oakland. You know, he thinks that a lot of his success of late has come from just learning to take chances and like take shots early in plate appearances, and that can mean, you know, just being more aggressive on a certain pitch, right? Like sitting on a certain pitch in a certain part of the zone, thinking more get out front, starting the swing a little bit earlier, thinking more pull side. And like you can look at the exit velo numbers, and like there's a real discrepancy from Horwitz's like first however many weeks in AAA this season to like his last 2 weeks. You know, throughout, like up until May 24th, his average exit velo was around 88 miles per hour. And then over the last 2 weeks for his call up, it was around 93. So he was like generating a lot more pop. We were starting to see the ball leave the yard a lot more. That's all well and good, but I almost feel like the best benefit that Spencer Horwitz can bring the Blue Jays is what you said, like putting the ball in play and like singles and doubles and just like sheer hits. because I'll kind of get around to this, but like I'm kind of done with like yelling and screaming about how the Blue Jays don't hit enough home runs and about how they need to find ways to hit more home runs. Like if this team's going to be successful, it's going to be with like the Spencer Horwitz approach of like walks and base hits. I just don't think that the home runs are going to arrive for this team. So if Spencer Horwitz wants to be the guy that he was prior to those final 2 weeks in AAA, not that that wouldn't help, but like I think that the Spencer Horwitz that who he probably just is as a ball player, I think that will really help the Blue Jays.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. I think when you look at just how the Blue Jays are being pitched, this is a group that sees a lot of fastballs. They don't hit fastballs. They don't hit sliders as a group. So not a great place to be. I don't think that you can fundamentally change who you are as an offense midstream. They kind of have who they have. So Horwitz is, in some ways, this is like the card they have to play because he's in the organization and he's producing. So play it, see what he can do. But yeah, I think some guys can hit homers on this team. Like I think that, you know, Danny Jansen, Vlad Jr., Davis Schneider, I think you expect those guys to continue running into the ball and driving it over the fence.
Sends a fly ball to right. He's hit it well. And it's gone! Davis Schneider sends him home by walking it off with a two-run homer.
I think in the case of Kirk, we might have thought he was going to be a home run hitter 2 years ago. Just not the case. IKF, I mean, clearly it's not who he is. Justin Turner at this point in his career, not a home run hitter. Same with Kiermaier. So, you know, Bo, you'd probably like to see a bit more power. So I still think if you're the Jays, you want and need more home runs than what you've had. But like you say, this is not fundamentally going to be a team that leads the majors in home runs. They're not some sleeping giant that's about to go on this binge of, you know, multi-home run game after multi-home run game.
Yeah, you want and need more home runs. I'm no longer anticipating it or waiting for it or thinking that it's coming. I'm looking at a Blue Jays team right now that only has three players who have hit more than five and no players that have hit more than 10. And that, like, these are the cold hard facts. You mentioned the fastballs as well. Blue Jays see a higher rate of fastballs on a percentage basis than any team in baseball. And they have the lowest slugging percentage against them. I just don't think the home runs are going to show up unless, like,
right,
the, you know, the hitters are going to change who they are dramatically.
Right. I mean, those numbers are that's pretty telling, right? You want to slug against fastballs. You really do. Right. That's a great thing to be able to do as a major league hitter. And for whatever reason or reasons, this is just, it hasn't happened for the Jays. So.
And you flip those leaderboards and you look at the teams that do slug against fastballs and the teams that, like, you know, the Blue Jays, by it's not only the worst slugging percentage of baseball, it's also like a bottom five batting average and a, you know, bottom three weighted on base average, like the second lowest average exit velocity against fastballs, like all the numbers are bottom of the league. And you flip these leaderboards, you look at the teams that like eat fastballs for dinner. It's the Phillies and it's the Yankees and it's the Dodgers. Like it's the Orioles. It's the best teams in baseball. Now, like a lot of that happens because obviously those teams just have really good offenses in general, but like if the Blue Jays want to have a better offense, like they're going to have to do better against fastballs. Otherwise, the opposition, who have clearly recognized this, the Blue Jays see more fastballs on a percentage basis than anyone in baseball, are just going to continue challenging them with these fastballs until the Blue Jays can prove that they can hit them and do damage against them, and we just haven't seen that.
Right. And so here's the thing, and I was kind of dancing around this earlier without really properly articulating it. So let me do a take two here, essentially. But the Blue Jays, as much as they have these flaws on this team, and they're still below 500, and they still have so much work to do, they are actually in the best spot that we've seen in quite some time, probably in 4 or 5 weeks, to be three games out, to be a couple games under the split against the Orioles to kind of salvage that, win a series against Oakland. They actually are in an okay spot. Now, to me, where this leads directionally is hold for now, like play it out and hold, not seeing drastic changes, not anticipating drastic personnel or leadership changes anytime soon. And then at the deadline, you maybe veer in one direction or the other. It's not a simple buy sell binary because you can do a little bit of both. You could, you know, move a position player you're not using as much. You could acquire a reliever. You can do some different things. I don't anticipate one way or the other that we're looking at, you know, we've talked about, hey, don't expect a huge sell scenario. I also don't expect a huge buy scenario for this team. So even if they do get to 500, hey, they're 60-60 on July 30th. Great. They're in it. They're still three games out. I'm not sitting here expecting that they're going to go acquire the big name at the deadline.
No, it would be a soft sell or a cautious buy. I think
that's what I think.
Yeah, those are the and I agree with you. Like, I don't think that there's like in either direction. I don't think there's reason to be aggressive in buying, but I also don't think there's a reason to be like overly aggressive in selling and like trading a Vladimir Guerrero Jr., a Bo Bichette, or like people who are under contract beyond this year. Like, I think the Blue Jays should, like, if they do get to a sell place, and we've talked about this, they obviously like trade off anybody who's a pending free agent and try to recoup some value there. And then you think about how you can retool and build a contender that will perform better in 2025, because like the roots of this team, the structure of it, like the core of it, like there's still some really good pieces there, and you can still build a contender for 2025, even if things don't work out in 24.
Hey, so let me ask you this, because who knows? This might be our only week of the year where we can talk about the Blue Jays as buyers. So I don't want to let it go by without at least considering what that possibility would look like. You know, if they go 0-7, then, you know, that discussion sort of ends. But if they do get to the deadline and they're, you know, let's say they're 61-58 and they're one game out of a playoff spot, and the pool of contenders remains kind of murky, what would you do if you're the Jays?
Left-handed hitter who can play third base, second base, or corner outfield, and at least one reliever who you trust in leverage, if not two.
Yeah, and I think the first part of that kind of depends on how Horwitz does, because ideally he's that guy for them. And then, yeah, you need leverage relief. Their bullpen has just been not close to good enough. How about a starting pitcher?
Yeah, I mean, if it's out there and if it makes sense, like, you know, the prices for starting pitchers are obviously and, you know, rightly usually pretty high. But yeah, I mean, if you're able to acquire one and the value makes sense, I think you could do that. But it would really just depend on what's available.
Bats, starters, relief arms. Yeah, I think it would all be on the table. I think that relief arms are probably the clearest spot, and also probably the easiest, because there are so many relievers in baseball that you could legitimately find someone to help you in the bullpen. Finding a viable big league starting pitcher, that's tougher. Finding a position player who fits your needs, you know, that can be kind of tricky just because not every team lines up with you in that way. So I think any of those would be possible. And I'll say this too, we're a long way from that. I understand that. I'm just indulging this kind of moment right here where they're, you know, a mere two games under 500 and having the thought experiment. But if they were to get into a situation where they're above, I don't think it's too wild to say that you could consider trading some, you know, interesting prospects. Like, to me, someone like an Addison Barger would be on the table when you're talking about trying to upgrade this team.
Yeah, I don't think that there's such a thing as an untouchable prospect. And I definitely, in the Blue Jays system, don't think that there's one if it came to that. Can I circle back to the offense? Because I was building towards something there.
Sure.
And that is that, and I don't know that I ever thought that I would say this, I think the Blue Jays should play more small ball. I think that like the Blue Jays should be trying to manufacture more runs. Like, I just think this is just what the team is. And this, like, part of this is like me just saying, all right, I'm not gonna like yell about home runs anymore. Like, it's over. It is what it is. The other side of that is kind of what we saw the last day in Oakland and how the Blue Jays like put together some runs with some situational hitting and some run manufacturing in really critical scenarios. So like, obviously I think of what Isaiah Kiner-Falefa did with runners on second and third and less than two out in the second inning. Like, he had an approach there and a plan to get that runner home from third, like, come hook or come crook. Like, he was going to get that guy in no matter what, even if he made an out. Obviously found a way to come up with a hit, didn't try to do too much, cash both of those runners. But finding ways to score the runner from third with less than two outs is huge. And then you think about what Kiner-Falefa did, obviously, in the 10th with that bases clearing double against a guy who was only throwing in sliders. If you talk to Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, he is always trying to hit the fastball. I remember talking about this preseason. He's got good numbers against four seamers. He hits velocity well. He is always looking fastball, but like he had faced Austin Adams in the series prior and also like in, you know, years prior and had an idea of what Austin Adams was going to do to him. Went up there with a plan, sit and slider, stuck to it, got a slider he could handle, cleared the bases in a really big spot.
And he has lined it up the alley in left center field, all the way to the wall. Here comes Bichette. Here comes Clement. Here comes Varsho. And IKF has cleared the bases.
Little things like that. I think about the eighth inning of that game when the Blue Jays are down one. And what happens? Dalton Varsho single. Isaiah Kiner-Falefa comes up. Blue Jays put on a bunt. Drop down the bunt. Varsho gets to second, and then Varsho like sneak attack steal of third when nobody is expecting it. This is part of the small ball I think the Blue Jays should do more of. They should run more. They should steal more bases because Varsho gets to third, and Davis Schneider, like really intelligently, when Varsho takes off, recognizes it and just like stands upright in the box to like get in the way of I'm pretty sure it was Langoliers behind the plate of the catcher, right? And just like didn't bend over, didn't swing, didn't like stay in whatever he was trying to do. He just like got in the way very subtly, made the throw harder, didn't like take Varsho's steal away from him by swinging, took whether it was a strike ball, whatever. Varsho gets the third, and then Davis Schneider with a really good approach to the opposite field, sacrifice fly, Varsho scores. Small ball. If the Blue Jays don't get a run there, like if they don't tie that game in the eighth, that game's over because it's Mason Miller time in the ninth and nobody can hit Mason Miller. The guy has like a 50% strikeout rate. So like, I think the Blue Jays should do little things like that more often because their starting pitching is so good that it's going to keep them in games more often than not. I think that more often than not, if the Blue Jays can get to four runs on average, they can win more often than not. They just need to find a way to score like one or two more runs than they are now because this isn't a team that's going to have 7, 8, 9 run outbursts. Like it just isn't that team. So like, let's just get to four, Ben. Like, let's just get a little bit higher. And then the starting pitching can be good enough to get deeper into starts, cover up for some holes in your bullpen, some shakiness there. And you know, you work your way to winning 54% of the time.
Well, you know, it's a, and the Jays might need a little more than that at this point, but yeah.
The portal ball, baby.
I do think that there are times where the Jays definitely can tap into that. And it definitely worked on the weekend. If you're in extra innings, do it. Small ball, for sure. You've got the runner on second base to start off the inning. That is a perfect time to use small ball. And we have seen the Jays employ that and employ it successfully. So definitely want to continue that. I think you look at the stolen base numbers. Jays have been very, very efficient. 36 of 41 stealing bases. That is an 88% success rate. So, you know, if they can steal a little more, then that's something that's worth doing. And to me, I guess like, to some extent, these things aren't incompatible, right? If it's the first inning, Vladdy can still try to go yard. Davis Schneider can still try to go yard. Tie game in the fourth, Danny Jansen still trying to pull it over the fence. So you can still do that. And later in the game, you can use the small ball if you need it. I guess where it becomes a sort of either or situation is, you know, you're down one in the fourth, you're tied in the seventh. Like, what do you do in those situations? Maybe it's, you know, do you ever ask someone like Vladdy or Bo to bunt? You know, that's kind of where the rubber meets the road on this stuff. But certainly in cases like, you know, you're tied, you got a runner on second, it's the seventh inning, run, like push it. They've had really good success so far. So in those situations, I would definitely agree. I think it's a clear chance to go for it.
Yeah, I don't think I would ever ask Vlad or Bo to bunt, but like I would ask Davis Schneider to. I would ask Dalton Varsho to, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, Kevin Kiermaier, Alejandro Kirk, Spencer Horowitz, Ernie Clement. Like I just named like half the roster. I would name all those guys to bunt. And I think a lot of those guys are actually really capable. Like IKF put down a perfect bunt in that eighth inning. We know Kevin Kiermaier can bunt really well. Dalton Varsho bunts for base hits all the time. Alejandro Kirk's bat control is so good that I'm positive like he could put down a really good sacrifice bunt. You know, I haven't seen Clement or Horowitz do it, but, you know, I would assume that they can. I just think the Blue Jays need to find a way to scrape across more runs. You look at it, like, the Blue Jays have scored one run or fewer 15 times this year. That is second in the big leagues to the White Sox, who have done it 18 times. You need to be scoring more than one run, but you're not going to score eight. So let's just get it to four. Like, let's just get it there right, by manufacturing some runs, by scraping some runs together. When you get, like, I don't know, the error that gets a guy on, or you get that leadoff double from Vladdy, like, let's just find a way to, like, make sure you get him in. Because, like, playing for the big inning, like, the Blue Jays just aren't a big inning team. Like, that's just not what they're going to be.
Yeah.
So I think that it's just time to think, you know, we make a lot of contact. We make good swing decisions. We have good approaches, all that stuff. Let's use that to our favor to get to four runs more often than not.
Fourth inning, runner on first base, nobody out, Ernie Clement batting. Are you bunting?
Let's do it.
You're bunting. Wow. So you, wow, you really do want, are ready for some small ball. Sixth inning.
You think Ernie Clement's coming up with the big hit there? Or do you think that it makes more sense to, like, get him over? Who's coming up behind Ernie Clement? Is it the big question too?
To me, in a, let's say he's batting ninth, or Kiermaier's behind him, eighth or ninth. To me, fourth inning, tie game, runner on first, I'm not bunting. Sixth inning, down, you're down one. You got a runner on second base, leadoff double, and Davis Schneider comes up. You need one run to tie the game.
Hopefully, Bo Bichette's sitting behind him, and I'm bunting that runner over for Bo.
You're bunting that runner over. Man, you are ready to bunt.
I'm ready to bunt, man. I'm ready for bunts.
Wow.
And
okay.
I'm ready for small ball. I'm ready for hit and runs. I'm ready for stolen bases. Like, this team needs to be stealing. Like, Dalton Varsho needs to be running more than he has.
I agree with you on
Kevin Kiermaier needs to be running more. Bo Bichette can steal bases. Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, honestly, can steal bases. Ernie Clement is, like, probably the fastest guy on the team. He needs to be running more. Like, I just think that the Blue Jays need to be, like, making more things happen. I think they need to be, like, a 1980s ball club. And maybe part of that is just because, like, it would be more fun to watch than what we're watching right now. But they need to find a way to stop scoring one run a game.
Yeah.
They've done that 15 times.
Their pitching is good
enough that if they score four, more often than not, they should be able to win those games.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting discussion. I'm actually interested to learn that you are this far down the bunting road. And I suspect a lot of people listening agree with you. I don't think that, I'm sure you're not alone in this. I'm with you to a point. And on stolen bases, I'm very much with you. I think, run. You're stealing at an 88% success rate. You should be getting caught more. And you should be pushing that, you know, 80%, that's fine. Find a few of those edge cases and run more often. Like you say, with guys like Varsho, Kiermaier, when he gets on, they're fast. They have good instincts out there. To me, where I sort of separate and don't quite land with you on this one would be those kind of mid-game situations that we're talking about there. The fourth or sixth inning, game is within a run or so. At that point, you got a Davis Schneider up, down one. I'm still swinging away.
Yeah, and I'm being tongue-in-cheek with those ones. I'm just trying to, you know, dig my feet into the sand a little bit. In those situations, if I'm really calling the shots, I need to show faith in my player in that spot, right? Like, I need to show faith in Clement and Schneider in those spots and not ask them to bunt, because I don't want to submarine their confidence. I don't want them to think that I don't have confidence that they can get those hits. So I would not be, in a real-world scenario, if I was pulling the strings, which I never will be and never should be, I would not actually be calling for bunts there. But I think that, you know, you look at the way that the Blue Jays beat the A's in that final game, man, that was such a, it sounds weird, but, like, that was such a significant win. Like, that was just a massive swing game. You know, if you drop 2-3 against Oakland and you're going to Milwaukee to play the Brewers, you know, like, the Blue Jays come from behind in that game on the road, on a bullpen day as well, right? Like, you don't have Kevin Gausman going nine. Like, you don't have Chris Bassett going eight. Like, it's a bullpen day. You're going to be, like, mixing and matching and patching it together with your pitching staff. I thought what the Blue Jays did in the eighth inning was just so critical, because, you know, Mason Miller's coming in the ninth. So that's essentially an eight inning game, really. Like, if they don't score there, that game's over. And the Blue Jays found a way to do it with, you know, a timely single, like a leadoff single, a bunt, a stolen base, and a sacrifice fly. All right, let's step away. But when we come back, we should talk Kevin Biggio. We should talk Alek Manoah. We should talk pitching, all that and so much more when it continues on At the Letters.
Listen to At the Letters ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
It continues on At the Letters. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson Smith. Our producers are Nick Andrade and Christian Ryan. Ben, as we spoke about in the first half, you could tell that Spencer Horwitz's day was coming and that his call-up was imminent last week. We knew that. What we didn't know is what the corresponding roster move was going to be and how the Blue Jays were going to get him onto their 26-man big league roster. So when it did happen on Friday in Oakland and you saw that the corresponding move was Kevin Biggio designated for assignment, your reaction was what?
Yeah, I was surprised for sure. I had just wrapped up a run and opened up my phone to see if what I'd missed in the world. And yeah, Kevin Biggio DFA was not what I was expecting at that point. So looking at it in the days preceding, I think it was pretty clear that someone was going to have to go off the roster. I wondered if someone might just be hurt, you know, nagging sort of thing 2.5 months into the season. Does someone need a 10-day breather on the IL? And then barring that, I kind of wondered about someone like Ernie Clement, because Ernie Clement just hasn't performed offensively. And in fact, his offensive numbers are worse than Kevin Biggio's. So I thought it would have been Ernie. You know, you look at this move and the way things were trending for Biggio, probably would have been a non-tender candidate this offseason, just given where his salary would have gotten to. He's already making $4.2 million this year. So we figure with a raise, that puts him to $5+ million. Probably not something that the Jays would have done. So we're talking about 2024 in either case. Who can help you for the next 3.5 months the most? And obviously the Jays decided that Clement can help them more.
What I thought was going to happen, and I believe there's actually some text message history to support this claim, was that Kevin Biggio would go on the IL with left shoulder tendonitis because he legitimately does have left shoulder tendonitis. I think if the Blue Jays imaged him, they would find they would be able to support an IL stint for him. I don't even think it would be that much of the phantom ILing that you have been suggesting for a couple episodes now for some player to open up room for, you know, whether it's a Horwitz or a Barger or a Nathan Lucas, who, by the way, side note, just a very quick sidebar, like Nathan Lucas injured his left thumb in a game with the Buffalo Bisons on the weekend, tried to play the following day, wasn't able to get it going, was removed from the lineup. I believe he's now on the IL. If he isn't, he will be soon, and he will not be available for some time. We'll see like what the extent of the injury is and, you know, how much time he's going to miss, but Nathan Lucas would have been the guy if the Blue Jays needed an outfielder. He like damn near made this team in spring, maybe on merit should have made the team in spring, but he's not going to be an option for the Blue Jays for the foreseeable future. So that's, you know, that is something to keep in mind if the Blue Jays have an opening. You know, it's not like Kevin Kiermaier and George Springer don't have injury histories. But yeah, when it comes to Biggio, like, you know, this is a guy who played through, you know, a lot more injuries than I think fans are even aware of. And I think that he could have been IL'd legitimately. He like had the left shoulder tendonitis issue in spring and like told me it's something he's battled for years and something that he's managed. And I kind of wonder, like, I don't know this. Like, I wonder if that option was presented to him and if he didn't take it. We know that like the Blue Jays could have, you know, offered to option him. That's a weird way of putting it, but like he has an option remaining, but like as a 5 years of service time guy, like he had the right to refuse that option. So I wonder if that was presented to him. Like, I would think that as a guy who's been with the organization for 9 years and has been like a really good loyal soldier for the Blue Jays and a big part of their culture and of their clubhouse, that the Blue Jays, you know, John Schneider, Ross Atkins would have sat down with Biggio and said like, hey, we're going to be making some sort of a move with you. What do you want that move to look like? I'm speculating, but like, I imagine that they would have had that kind of open discussion with him before going the DFA route, because like Kevin Biggio was a big leaguer. You know, he would have been an awkward fit with Horwitz and Clement on the roster. Like, there would have been a lot of redundancy there, but he's a big leaguer and he's someone that you want on your 40-man roster. So, you know, I don't know that the Blue Jays wanted to get rid of Kevin Biggio, but I think that he was going to be the guy who came off 26th for Horowitz, who had more than earned a big league opportunity, and just because some of the circumstances of the situation, it ended up being a DFA.
Yeah, he got 5 years of service within like weeks. Like, this is not, he entered the year with 4+ years of service and only recently crossed that 5-year marker, which would allow him gives him the right to approve any move to the minor leagues, any assignment to the minor leagues. So as we record this, we don't know where this DFA is going to lead. Could be a claim, could be a trade, could be that he's the Blue Jays do try to outright him to the minor leagues if he's not traded or claimed. We'll see. I mean, it's an interesting point of reflection, right? Because in a lot of ways, he was linked to Bo and Vladdy. They obviously are all sons of major leaguers. Everyone listening knows that. And prominent major leaguers at that, you know, probably more so than like a Gary Varsho. And they debuted after coming up through the minor leagues, winning together in the minor leagues. They debuted within a period of like months in 2019. Like, it all happened so rapid fire. So of course they're going to be linked, but you know, if you look back, I'm sure that what was being written and said at the time, even people who were really plugged in around the team knew that Kevin Biggio did not have the same ceiling that a Bo Bichette or a Vlad Jr. had. But at the same time, he still was an important part of this team for 5 years, and he still did some good things on the field. I mean, you just look at the WAR, and Kevin Biggio had 7.4 WAR as a Blue Jay. That's actually pretty high. And if you look back at the players this front office has drafted, that is one of the most productive players behind Bichette, behind Alek Manoah by fractions of a WAR. He is like third among all the players that they have ever drafted in WAR.
Oh yeah, he's a success story for sure.
Like, oh yeah, fifth round, that's a great pick.
Great pick. And also a guy who, like, prior to getting to the big leagues in 2019, if you kind of asked about him, it was like, oh, he's an org guy. Like, maybe gets a cup of coffee someday. But like, Kevin Biggio found a way to like do enough things well to get to the big leagues and have like two, honestly, like pretty good seasons to begin his career, like 2019 and 2020. Like, he was totally solid and even an above average hitter.
Now Biggio sends a high fly ball deep down the right field line. It's gone! The first big league home run for Kevin Biggio.
For the last 4 years, he has been a below average MLB hitter, although he has still like contributed in a big way to the Blue Jays, you know, defensively playing a number of positions. Like, the base stealing was something that always impressed me. This is a guy who is 32 for 35 stealing bases in his career. He's been caught only 3 times trying to steal 35 bases. That's very impressive. The baseball IQ, he was always making heady plays, always in the right place, always making the right throw, like just very instinctual and quick. And like, it shows that he grew up around this game. Now, like, all that said, if you removed the name from it and like you just looked at it as like a meritocratic case, and you saw a guy who you know, has a 91 OPS plus over the last 4 years, and in none of those like singular years has had an OPS plus of 100, so has been like below league average OPS wise, and a guy who like was a part-time player for the last 3 years, and then this year like really wasn't playing at all, like it makes sense if you just remove the name Kevin Biggio from it. And if it's just like Joe Smith, you would think, yeah, no, like, that makes sense. The context of it is that, as you said, like, Kevin Biggio has put a lot of sweat equity into this franchise, and like vice versa, like the Blue Jays have been like very committed to Kevin Biggio as well. Like, this is a guy who's been in the organization for 9 years. This is a guy who came up the minors not only with Vlad and Bo, but with John Schneider as well. And like, we know how John Schneider feels about Kevin Biggio, like one of his biggest fans. And this is a guy who was like a quiet leader in the Blue Jays clubhouse, was like part of the fabric in there, honestly. Was like, I bet you he was blindsided by this decision. And I would bet that there were players in the Blue Jays clubhouse who were like blindsided by it as well. And I don't like, it would be hard to find somebody with the Blue Jays who like says a bad thing about Kevin Biggio as somebody to have around your environment. Right. And like, I include myself in that. Like, Kevin Biggio was just like such a pro's pro, and yeah, like, loved my interactions with him. Like, always insightful and open, and like gave you time and like would, you know, tolerate my very, very, very stupid questions and like give me really elegant like explanations of things that were going on. And like he was always working on something, which like speaks to his work ethic and to who he is as a guy and a ball player as well, is that he was always tweaking something. He was always working on something, always trying to get better at something specific, always trying to make an adjustment. And he explained them really well and understands the game really well. So like that, it's that context that makes it surprising, not so much the offensive production if you just remove his name from it.
Right. Exactly. I mean, there are two elements there. One, the name Biggio, that's always going to just have weight in baseball circles. And then two, even if he had been named Joe Smith or Breivik Valera or whoever, and he had been in the organization for now, you know, in his ninth season, there would be a history there. So you combine those things and yeah, he means more, has meant more to the Blue Jays than your standard bench player. I mean, I think that's pretty clear. But it's interesting, right? Because part of me thinks, okay, so it is meritocratic then, you know, they're moving in this direction of you got to produce. But then I actually land on, I don't feel as though this season has been fully meritocratic. Just when you look at how long it took them to get George Springer out of the leadoff spot, even the fact that Springer's playing as often as he is right now, I'm not saying bench the guy. He's obviously, you know, has a history as a productive major leaguer, but I don't know that he needs to be playing 6 days a week. I mean, it could be four or five. Justin Turner too has continued to get a ton of playing time. And I know he's been better, you know, the last week or so, but when I look at the Jays and the way they've made decisions, especially with their offensive playing time and lineup decisions, it still hasn't felt fully meritocratic this year.
Three things, and I will be quick. I won't talk forever here. But number one, I picked Joe Smith as just like a Jane Doe type of like filler name. And then when I heard you say it, I was like, oh, there actually was a Joe Smith who was a Toronto right. Blue Jay. It's like a sidearming righty reliever was with the team for like half a year. So I should have gone with like Jane Doe or Jack Doe or something like that. Number two, yeah, the Blue Jays, like they have time right now to work out a trade. You know who else was recently designated for assignment? Former Blue Jay Harold Ramirez was designated for assignment from the Tampa Bay Rays. He is making $3.8 million this season. Kevin Biggio is making $4.2 million. There's your trade right there. The Blue Jays could use some pop. Harold Ramirez has shown it. He can play corner outfield. It's not a great corner outfield, but as we've seen recently, defense not exactly a priority for the Blue Jays right now. And Harold Ramirez, a guy who John Schneider is very familiar with, like knows him from Double A when he managed him. This is a guy who's in the Blue Jays system.
On the team with Biggio yeah. and Vlad and Bo. Let's just create the Fisher Cats.
they know him well. So, you know, make the money equal, right? Biz is 4.2. Ramirez is 3.8. Make the money equal. Swap those two guys. It's like a weird little challenge trade almost. But it, I don't know that it necessarily makes sense for the Rays, but it makes sense for my head and wanting to see it happen. So that's number two. Number three.
Just quickly on that, Harold Ramirez, another DH to the Blue Jays mix, exactly what they need just to push this thing forward as another positionless player with an OPS plus well south of 100.
Well, and that leads me to my third point, and that is that we have seen the Blue Jays making like just incrementally more and more like drastic moves with their roster, and it's never as quick as like, you know, we would call for it or like certainly fans would call for it. Like the Blue Jays certainly like exercise a lot more patience with these things, but like it started with, you know, okay, Davis Schneider isn't going to be a platoon bench bat for us. He's going to be an everyday player. And then it was, okay, Bo Bichette isn't just going to like hit second or third every day. We're going to drop him down the lineup. And then it was, we're going to drop George Springer down the lineup. And then it was, we're going to cut back, you know, Turner's playing time a little bit. And then it was, okay, we're going to like start playing Vladimir Guerrero Jr. at third base and just punting on defense, forget run prevention. We're going to weaken ourselves defensively in order to try to get some more offense in here. And then it was, okay, let's DFA a guy who's been with the organization for 9 years and a guy who's been on the big league roster for like the last five in order to get Spencer Horwitz up here and hit him second and sometimes lead off. So like we are seeing progressively like more and more drastic maneuvers from the Blue Jays as they try to just like fire every bullet that they have to try to turn this season around and get to that point that you were suggesting where they could get to and be soft sellers at the deadline. So maybe buyers. You're right, be soft buyers at the deadline.
They've got it in your head already.
Well, that's a tell. That's Freudian of what I. Yeah, exactly. That's a tell. But perhaps as things continue to get more drastic, we do see what you're suggesting, where like a veteran, big name player on this team, sees their role decrease more substantially than it already has, or perhaps sees themselves no longer on the team. Like things have steadily, just slowly, like the frog has been just boiling a little bit more. It's been getting a little more drastic. So maybe we do get there.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even think it's that drastic of a suggestion. When it comes to, you know, Springer playing 4 or 5 days a week. I mean,
he makes really $25 million.
Great. So he's getting compensated, you know, like he should be fine either way. Sounds like he's pretty set for life. Like, so you got to take care of the team. I don't know. Like same with Turner, like he's making $13 million. So he's doing fine. What about the Blue Jays?
That's not my point, right? Like, obviously, like, my point is that like that has after effects, or that has aftershocks in a clubhouse. Like there's fallout from that can change confidence, that can like alter perception, that, you know, like those moves like those are not taken lightly.
Agreed. And that's accurate in describing how teams think about it. But, and again, I'm not saying bench anyone. I'm not saying that George Springer isn't an important part of this team. He is. His defense has been really excellent this year, and I'm sure better things are ahead for him at the plate. And it's not like their bench is overflowing with answers that you absolutely have to get into the lineup every single day. But at the same time, I think 4 or 5 days a week would be fine. I'm not saying you have to go and rush and pull the rug out from under anyone. But when it comes to Springer and Turner in particular, I don't know that their performance equates to playing 7 days a week. I'm not there.
Yeah, the tricky thing is, and to your, you mentioned it, who are you thrusting in to the lineup, right? Like, is it more Daniel Vogelback? Is it more Alejandro Kirk at DH? Like, quietly, Kirk has set career highs in average exit velo the last 2 months. Like, May was a career high, and so far in June, he has exceeded that career high. Now, that seems to correlate, as we've seen over time, with Kirk's playing time not being super frequent. Like, it seems to correlate with him playing 2 or 3 times, every 5 to 6 games. So if you start giving him more workload, does that impact the results? Like, there aren't obvious candidates to have their playing time increased right now, which, probably says something about the Blue Jays roster.
Right. I mean, yeah, I think Horwitz is the one guy right now where you kind of have an up arrow. You want him in there. They're obviously getting him in there. That's good. Keep on doing that. Then, you know, with Vogelback, he's been making more hard contact recently. He and Turner, if that shifts a little bit more into a DH platoon, I don't think that's a bad thing. Clearly, we're seeing the Blue Jays don't want to deploy Turner at third base, for example, which going into the season was something that we thought they might do from time to time. There may be matchups where it's a good day for Kevin Kiermaier to get in there against certain right-handed pitchers, for example. The Jays have lots of ways to look into that stuff. If it's a good matchup for Kiermaier, maybe you get him in center field. Maybe that's a day for Springer to get off his feet. Kiermaier's in the lineup. Maybe Springer comes in later in the game too. It's not to say it's a full day off, but you know, there are ways that you can deploy these things. And I just think, you know, we're into June. We're into heading toward the middle of June. You got to win, and you got to find whatever advantages they have. And I like that the Blue Jays are trending in the direction of taking some more chances and doing things more differently. And I think they need to lean into that more.
Yeah, the tough thing with the DH platoon is that like you don't see lefties all that often. So, I mean, that would be a serious reduction in Justin Turner's playing time. And I think that, you know, you want him, like you're trying to get him going is the thing.
Yep.
So you're trying to, and I know that can be, there's some dissonance there, right? Where it's like the guy isn't performing, give him more playing time, right? Like I understand, But like, this is the way the teams think about it, is like, we need to give him opportunity to get out of this. Like, we need to get him into a rhythm and give him consistent playing time. I know that's how coaches think about it, because like, obviously there's more in that bat. The guy's track record speaks for itself, even if he is 39. Like, you just look at like what he did last year. Like, clearly there still is something to contribute here. So I think the Blue Jays would think like, if they went straight platoon with Turner and Vogelback, they would just like not be playing Turner enough in order to give him the opportunity to get his bat going.
Agreed. And I think straight platoon, not the way to go. But, you know, if it drifts a little more in that direction where Turner, you know, against some right-handed pitching, you know, maybe those are the 2-3 days a week that Turner sits, right? And then so he gets 4 as a starter. He's in there a couple more times as a bat off the bench. Still ends up playing in most of your games. But Vogelback against right-handed pitchers, you know, that can be a matchup that's preferable in some situations. And again, I understand that's, you know, Daniel Vogelback, again, as I said last week, he's on pace for a 3-home-run season. So it's not as though this is someone that you absolutely have to get in there. But all I'm saying is, the more you lean into the direction of meritocracy, the better, in my opinion. I don't think that looking at track records, you know, for what someone did 2-3 years ago is that helpful at this point. Like what Springer did in 2022, what he did in 2021, it's like, it's kind of irrelevant. You have to look at who he is right now.
All right, let's wrap up on pitching. And there's a couple obvious threads here, and I'll let you follow whichever one interests you. Number one, Alek Manoah, his season is over. He is going to be having surgery on June the 17th, some sort of an elbow procedure. We won't know until after Dr. Keith Meister has gone in there and assessed the damage and decided what to do. But I do think it is worth noting that Keith Meister, if you follow some of his public commentary, is like a pretty big advocate for the hybrid surgery where you get both a Tommy John, which repairs the UCL, the ulnar collateral ligament, and then an internal brace on top of that to further fortify the UCL. So we'll see, but that is something that you know, Meister has been fond of, and just wishing Alek Manoah like all the best with that and his recovery. And then like the second thread would be like, holy smokes, Blue Jays starters like just continue to like exceed even my lofty expectations. Like what Chris Bassitt and Kevin Gausman did in Oakland on the weekend was like remarkable. The Blue Jays go the first 2 games of that series with their bullpen throwing one singular pitch. Kevin Gausman just like brilliant on Saturday, making a little adjustment with his leg kick to be a bit more towards third base than straight in front of him. The idea is that you know, he'll leak less energy, and then, you know, leak less velocity, and his splitter will carry the zone. He'll stay through his splitter a bit more. He'll get that great strike to ball action. Talking to Pete Walker, he thought that Gausman got a little bit away from his delivery earlier this year, and they think that they found some things, some adjustments he can make so that the velo is more consistent, the splitter action is more consistent. Certainly looked that way on Saturday, and then like Chris Bassitt just doing Chris Bassitt things on Friday. It's just, you know, it's remarkable. You look at some of the rough outings he had earlier this year, and it's like kind of mirrors his last season where he had like some rough ones in the early going, and yet here he is in early June, and the ERA is like 3.8. And you know, getting close to the 3.6 it was last year. So I just continue to be impressed and astounded at the things that Blue Jays starters are doing.
Yeah, let's start with the established veteran starting pitchers, and then get back to Manoah to wrap up here. But as far as, yeah, Gausman, Bassitt, Berríos, Kikuchi, it's really the backbone of this team in a lot of ways. And as much as there are concerns on the offensive side, as we discussed, and on the bullpen, which, you know, we haven't really gotten into this week, but we know that they're there, and we've talked about that many times. Yeah, the starting pitching has really kind of found itself as the season has progressed as well, with the exception of Berríos, who just was consistent from the jump. But Bassitt has found a better rhythm. Gausman certainly took a while just with the injury that delayed his start this spring, but rounded into form, obviously, really a career type game for him over the weekend to pitch that complete game shutout. And even Kikuchi too, right? To be able to get a win. He went 7 starts between the Blue Jays winning one of his starts that weighed kind of heavily on him before finally getting that win and feeling a sense of relief to be able to contribute to a Blue Jays victory, even though he had pitched actually quite well during those 7 starts. Yeah, we're seeing this group round into form, and they're just a huge part of why the Blue Jays are still in this thing. And if the Blue Jays are going to somehow make it to the postseason, and certainly if they're ever going to win four playoff rounds, this group is essential to that.
Yeah, I should have put Kikuchi in that list because like that start against Orioles was insane. Like the stuff he was featuring was just deadly. He had like over 20 whiffs that day and he only threw six innings. Like it's just he was just unreal that day. You know, Jose Berríos, like I totally would echo everything you said. Like the guys, you know, his bad start, which is we kind of saw Monday in Milwaukee, is three runs over five and two thirds. So like his down start is one out from a quality start. Like that's him after the game being like, I wasn't good enough. I didn't have my stuff. I'll be better going forward. It's like, if you got five and two, most teams like have, you know, two guys in their rotation who, if they got five and two thirds and three runs out of, they're like, wow, great. You put us in a position to win, you know? So like that's his down start. Like Chris Bassitt doing Chris Bassitt things is exceptional to watch. And then like, yeah, you know, seeing Kevin Gausman continue to make adjustments like later into his career is really cool. And like kind of trying to stay ahead of the league a little bit and stay ahead of, you know, what teams are trying to do to him. You see him incorporating that sinker, which has been like such a good weapon for him against righties. Like I just think that that's helping his splitter a lot. And then obviously like this little mechanical adjustment to help him stay over the rubber a bit more, I think is, you know, really going to help him. And like that process continues. Like talking to Pete Walker, he said, yeah, it's still a work in progress with Gausman's delivery. You know, all pitchers kind of get away from their deliveries over time. But, you know, there is a lot of encouraging signs that, you know, Gausman's going to look a lot more like himself going forward than he did earlier this year.
Yeah, they need that, especially because, all right, let's get to Manoah here. So he's out for the season, obviously, and this creates a gap in the Blue Jays rotation, which we knew. But this is really a bigger picture setback for Manoah, of course. And yeah, I would echo what you said, wishing him the best as he recovers. And also for the Blue Jays, because Manoah quietly had kind of come back and established that, hey, he can be a helpful major league starter again. Now, for the rest of this year, he's out. And then depending on the recovery timetable, which, as you said, is sort of in flux, then, you know, for Tommy John anyway, it's 12 to 18 months. So when Hyunjin Ryu and Chad Green underwent Tommy John surgery in June of 2022, it took them until August, in Green's case, it was a little later, closer to September, to be able to come back. So, you know, that tells you that even in a pretty good case scenario, Manoah is coming back toward the end of next year. So the Blue Jays, obviously set to lose Yusei Kikuchi. We've talked about that at length in the first couple months of the season here, and they won't have Alek Manoah to start the season. So this says to me, organizationally, they need to find starting pitching. And you can say that about any team at any time, but I think for the Blue Jays, that need is a little more pronounced right now with Manoah set to miss at least the first half of next year.
Yeah, that's a short and long-term thing. And like the long-term part of it is that the Blue Jays need to go out and get two legitimate big league starters going to 2025 if they're not bringing back Kikuchi. Because like Yariel Rodriguez like could be a starter for them next year, but like there's still a lot of uncertainty there with how that's going to look and how that's going to play out. So like the Blue Jays this winter are going to need to acquire, in my opinion, like two legitimate big leaguers. And then the short-term like side of that is what we're seeing right now, and semi-related to that is the lack of starting pitching depth in the organization. Like the Blue Jays don't have a fifth starter. Right now they've got like Bowden Francis in that spot. It's interesting, like Yariel Rodriguez, after he pitches for Buffalo, he's going to pitch here on Tuesday and get up to 70-75 pitches. He might be ready to step into that next time out. You don't know. If not, I would expect, you know, Francis to get another go. He, like, that slider was, you know, looking pretty good for him against against Oakland on Sunday. The splitter was broken out a little bit more often as well. Still got to find a way to get his fastball to play up a bit more. It just hasn't been the same as it was in spring training, but you know, we'll see what the role looks like for him. But you know, I think that ideally the Blue Jays would like Yariel Rodriguez to be a starter. They'd like to get him into that spot, but you're working with obvious workload limitations with him, considering not only the fact that he didn't pitch competitively in 2023, but now he's had two injuries in 2024. So they're going to need to be cautious with his workload going forward. So even if he does kind of fill into that spot, I don't think you're going to see him throwing 100 pitches very often. So, you know, in a way, like it's going to be somewhat of a bullpen day or a day on which you expect to use your bullpen going forward, unless I am missing somebody from within who is ready to step up and be a legit starter.
No, I don't think you are. I mean, I have kind of asked myself the same question and pored over the depth charts, and it's kind of like I don't see where that answer is coming from. So I am anticipating that you're looking at a kind of bullpen day, and that will take a toll and it will not be ideal. And it'll be really interesting to look up in a couple months and see, you know, on those days, what was the runs allowed per game? You know, what was the team's win-loss record? Obviously, we're just in the early stages of that now, but it's going to be a challenge. That will be a challenge for the Jays, because even in this dream scenario where they have a really good couple months, they get back into it, it's not like it's easy to acquire starting pitching at the deadline. That's why if they are selling, conversely, then Yusei Kikuchi would have a ton of value, because there's just not that much out there. So would agree, going into the offseason, they will be in the market for starting pitching. That's 100% certain. And I also think it points to, you look at, okay, Manoah, he is by far, if you look at this objectively, the best, the most successful pitching draft pick that the Blue Jays front office has made in their 8 drafts since coming to Toronto. That's Shapiro and Atkins having overseen the draft since 2016. And Manoah, who is a 2019 draft pick, easily the best pitching draft pick they've ever made. And there's not really a lot percolating in, say, AAA that's, you know, close to contributing. In AA, they have Adam Mako, who came back as part of the Teoscar Hernandez trade. He's having a really good season, so we'll see what happens there. Obviously, Ricky Tiedemann is hurt. We'll see if he's able to, you know, break through and contribute. But as a major league organization, if you're going to sustain competitiveness, you need to be drafting and developing starting pitching that can help you in the major leagues. And that's something that this front office talked about doing. And you look at the results, Manoah being by far the best of those, huge drop off after that. Those results have not been good enough to fortify this major league team in the way that you would hope.
Yeah, you know, Mako has been really promising. He's allowed 3 runs or fewer in 6 straight outings. He's got a 35% strikeout rate over that span. He's walked only 7 over those 32 innings. Like, walks were a big issue for him earlier in his career. Like, he's like looking like a legit guy. I think, honestly, with Ricky Tiedemann injured, like, if we put him aside because he's not available, Adam Mako is like their best pitching prospect in the organization. But to your point, not a guy they drafted. It's a guy who was acquired. And, you know, the Blue Jays, to their credit, like, they've been good at acquiring starting pitching, or let's just call it pitching. They've been good at acquiring pitching via free agency and trade. Like, I looked to Zach Pop, who has like emerged as a legit weapon in the Blue Jays bullpen. Like, on like his inning on Sunday against Oakland was as good as I've ever seen him. He strikes out the side on 11 pitches, and he was just electric.
Today, and now Pop coming in to face the 8-9-1 hitters of the Oakland A's. Got him again. That great two-seamer as he strikes out Diaz and strikes out another one. Back to back K's.
Swing and a miss. Strike 3, make it 102 strikeouts in the career of Pop, who strikes out the side all swinging.
And then he comes in on Monday and like gets the Blue Jays out of runners on jam with 4 pitches. Like, his stuff is looking legit. His sinker's unhittable when it's on. And now he's got that little cutter that he can throw into lefties to keep them from like hanging out over the plate. That's a new development for him. That's something the Blue Jays have helped him learn, to their credit. So, like, you know, kudos to them for that. And kudos to them for, you know, the free agent signings, obviously, of Kikuchi, Bassett, Gausman. All 3 of those have worked out brilliantly, and obviously the Jose Berríos trade and then subsequent extension, slam dunk. So they've done a really good job of acquiring pitching, but it's really hard and really costly to acquire pitching and to continue to like build your roster in that way. Eventually, like, you are going to want some homegrown pitching, some drafted and developed pitching, because that's just obviously like the most efficient way, like payroll wise and, you know, trade capital wise, to get good pitchers on your roster. Like, this is why, like, when you proposed, you know, if the Blue Jays are buyers at the deadline, how about a starting pitcher? I was like, yeah, sure. If you can A, afford it, you know, B, if there's any available, because if a team has like a really good, consistent starting pitcher, they're pretty loath to move them. Like you, teams aren't exactly trying to give those guys up unless they're like in a situation where they're, you know, like a pending free agent and not going to resign, or where maybe they know something that you don't, you know, health wise or mindset wise or whatever. Like that's just not a commodity that moves a ton. And when it does, it is extremely costly to acquire it. And I don't know that the Blue Jays have a ton of prospect capital with which to operate right now. So that's why I was like, yeah, sure, like go for it. But ultimately, you need to be developing pitching internally in order to be sustaining winning going forward.
Yeah, yeah, you really do. And it's tough to do, right? We say this a lot. It's a tough league. You're up against some real competition. Developing baseball prospects is really, really difficult. Not everyone is the LA Dodgers, right? But you should aspire to be, and you should certainly aspire to develop more starting pitching than the Blue Jays have. And we know that they did, because that's what they talked about, you know, for years. And any front office would talk about the need to develop starting pitching as part of that backbone, because you're not always going to have the free agent success rate that the Blue Jays have had in recent years. And you're right. That's huge. I mean, those acquisitions have been really, really good. You also need to sustain it. So you're not doing a bullpen game in a season where you need to compete. And so this is part of the challenge, you know, moving forward. That's an ongoing challenge. It's not something you try to fix in one day. But certainly when we look at this bullpen day and you kind of zoom out and say, why are they doing a bullpen day every 5 days in a season where so much is on the line? Some of that does connect to, hey, they have actually not developed enough major league caliber starting pitching.
Yeah. And you need to like almost over index on like acquiring pitching and drafting pitching and trying to like develop pitching, because there is so much attrition. Like you think about it coming into the season, if it was like, oh, you know, who are the Blue Jays like top pitching prospects? Ricky Tiedemann injured, Brandon Barriera surgery, Landon Marudas surgery, right? Like it's like there is so much attrition with pitchers, and there are so many that just like don't turn out, right? Like you think about what we were saying about Nate Pearson however many years ago when he was a prospect, and when he was looking like, whoa, this guy could be like front of the rotation dominant starter. And you kind of see where his career has led him now, where like, you know, at the age of 27, he's still kind of trying to figure things out in the Blue Jays bullpen. There's like attrition in terms of injury, and then attrition in terms of guys who just don't work out as starters, or just like can't withstand the workload, or just like can't put it all together. So you have to like over index on trying to draft and acquire via international market and develop pitching.
Right. And yeah, even their international successes, when you look back, it's been position player side, even really dating to Vladdy, but Kirk Moreno, Lourdes Gurriel Jr., their best international signings have been on the position player side. And hey, that's great. You need those guys. Those are super helpful additions. But yeah, you know, it never hurts to sign an international pitcher out of the Dominican, or, you know, find someone in Curacao or whatever the case. That's a part of the success for any team. So yeah, the Jays need to do some more of that.
Or Japan. Roki Sasaki, if he's posted, like the Blue Jays need to be all over that guy. Like talking to people who have seen him, like he is electric. And if he's getting posted from Japan this winter, like that is someone who the Blue Jays need to aggressively pursue. Like if they can find a way to, you know, acquire like the next Yamamoto, the next Darvish, next Otani, whatever. Like Otani's like obviously in a class of his own, but you know what I'm saying? Like the next, like, be aggressive in Japan, in Korea as well, because you can, you know, really, really unearth some gems there.
Aggressive pursuit of an electric Japanese star. What could go wrong for the Blue Jays? This won't be traumatizing for the fan base at all when he signs with the Dodgers. Yeah, I'm not gonna try to spark those rumors. The Jays obviously have interest in Sasaki, and they'll monitor him and show a serious interest, I'm sure, because they, you know, of course they will. But yeah, I'll tread carefully there.
He's Ben Nicholson Smith. I'm Arden Zwelling. I want to thank our producers, Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade. I want to thank you for listening. We will talk to you next time on At the Letters.